This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 11th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 430. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, a double feature to start 2026. First, the countdown to British Columbia's 2026 municipal elections. New Westminster councillor and mayoral candidate Daniel Fontaine joins me to talk about issues in the Royal City and Metro Vancouver. And then, Prime Minister Mark Carney is going to Beijing to talk trade with Xi Jinping, the world's most powerful dictator. Why should Canadians be concerned? My guest is Charles Burton, author of The Beaver and the Dragon, How China Outmaneuvered Canada's Diplomacy, Security, and Sovereignty. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. My guest joining me from Ottawa is Charles Burton, a former diplomat at Canada's embassy in Beijing. He's now a senior fellow at Prague-based Synopsis. In 2025, he authored a book that is called The Beaver and the Dragon, How China Outmaneuvered Canada's Diplomacy, Security, and Sovereignty. It's from Optimum Publishing. A lot happening in the first week or two of 2026, and China seems to be in the foreground or the background of both of those major stories.
Yes, I think that that's true. Certainly, our government last year declared that Canada's relationship with China is a strategic partnership. Well, what are China's other strategic partners? Russia, North Korea, Iran, they had a strategic partnership there with Venezuela. So does that mean that Mr. Carney suggests that Canada will be a strategic partner of China and a strategic partner of China's strategic partners? This is very troubling that we seem to be in the interest of expanding our Canadian market share in China and diversifying our trade, prepared to undertake relations with China on Chinese terms. And the Prime Minister has been echoing Chinese rhetoric, like pragmatic and constructive, or set aside differences while we seek common ground. And what that really seems to be is that Canada will no longer engage in any non-trade protection of our security and sovereignty and our commitment to the international rules-based order. So, we haven't acted on the June 2024 Bill C-70 passed unanimously through the House of Commons, which includes a foreign influence transparency registry and the appointment of a foreign influence transparency commissioner. The government has not appointed that person. There is no registry in Canada that requires people who have a conflict of interest because they're associated with a foreign power to have to declare that publicly, as most other countries have. And, we're not acting on Chinese espionage. We're not acting on the very serious allegations of the NCCOP, the Country Intelligence Committee, that there are 11 members of parliament and more, a larger number of staffers who are wittingly or unwittingly, as they put it, under the influence of a foreign power. All of these things, harassment of Uyghurs and Tibetans in Canada by the agents of the Chinese state, and the cyber espionage, and the concerns about China's ability to sabotage our critical infrastructure in time of conflict. There was a front page article in National Post about China's ability to interfere with water filtration. All of these things seem to be set aside while Mr. Carney seeks to expand our trade with China. But currently our external commodity trade to China is about 4%, just under 4% of our total external commodity trade, comparing, of course, with 76% for the United States, about 3.6% to the United Kingdom, 8% to the European Union. In other words, the idea that China somehow or other could salvage the economic damage that the Trump tariffs may do to the Canadian economy is complete and utter nonsense. It's not going to happen. And I would say, in addition, the Chinese economy is in very bad shape. And the idea that the Chinese government would agree to import substitution, you know, bringing in Canadian imports for stuff that China produces domestically, is definitely not in the cards. So you have that. And then, you know, you do have this situation that you raised with regard to Venezuela. And I think that has been quite damaging to China's prestige in the myriad tin pot dictators like Maduro that they support with their Belt and Road program and their funding. You know, they say that Venezuela is actually $20 billion in the hole to China that they'll probably never get back. But the big news is, as you say, the trade delegation that was in Caracas the day before the U.S. action, at which time that delegation declared unbreakable brotherhood with Maduro. So clearly the Chinese were not aware of what the U.S. was doing. So any surveillance and intelligence capability that they'd given to the Maduro regime, or hardware and software that they had provided, which would be designed to defend the Maduro regime against external action, has failed. And so I think for a lot of countries, they'll be looking at that. Those countries that think that China will save them from the demands of the United States, the Venezuela situation suggests that the U.S. just has far superior military capability, both in hardware and logistics, and that China just doesn't match up. So they're, as Chairman Mao might put it, a paper tiger. So that, you know, that is the context of Mr. Carney going to China. It seems that we want to cart our horse to a country which is in problems in terms of their domestic politics, and which internationally also seems to be not fulfilling the promise that the Chinese people have got from their regime, that China will continue to develop into a greater and greater power and replace the United States as the global hegemon. So I don't know what's going on there between our prime minister and the Chinese regime. And I'd sure like to find out a lot more about it, because what we're hearing now is not making an awful lot of sense. And I just say, finally, the latest news that the defector from the Conservative Party to the Liberals, Michael Ma, will be accompanying Mr. Carney to Beijing, sets up my antenna even higher into what's going on with that one.
Mark Carney has carried on Justin Trudeau's support for Ukraine and was most recently at the summit for the Coalition of the Willing. But here he is going to Beijing, which is Russia's biggest ally, which is helping fund Putin's war machine in Ukraine on one hand. On the other hand, it threatens to invade Taiwan. How can this conflict be resolved? That Mark Carney, on one hand, is supporting Ukraine, and the other hand, he wants closer relations with China.
Yeah, I mean, this strategic partnership thing is troubling. And, you know, the Prime Minister has said that he's seeking more investment from China into Canada. Does that mean that, you know, he wants the equivalent of the Belt and Road investment into infrastructure, into Canadian infrastructure? We've gone through this in the past when a Chinese state construction firm wanted to acquire our largest privately owned construction firm, Aecon, which we turned down. And then when the Huawei company wanted to provide very competitive bids on the 5G, that one gets the impression that China invests in foreign countries and provides these technologies to foreign countries if there is an opportunity for them to use these technologies for the purposes of espionage. So, you know, they seem to factor that into their deals on the basis that the Chinese regime is an integrated party, state, military, industrial complex that one thing serves another. So the idea that we would encourage more Chinese investment in Canada in critical areas troubles me a great deal because, as you say, we really can't trust Chinese firms not to provide critical information to their intelligence and security agencies. And in fact, under Chinese law, they are required to do so if this information is requested. So I'm concerned about that aspect. And then we move into, as you raised earlier, the EVs. The Chinese have stated very explicitly that they will remove their tariffs from Canadian canola seeds if we remove our 100% tariff on electric vehicles. Well, you know, maybe Mr. Carney thinks that if he holds this out to the Americans to say, well, you know, our auto sector will be in big trouble if you reshore production away from Southern Ontario back into the United States. So we might take these EVs if you go backwards on that, on your Trump policies to try and devastate our auto industry by insisting on producing the automobiles entirely within the borders of the United States. Perhaps we need those EVs to maintain our own auto industry. I don't think that kind of strategy would work with the Trump administration. I don't think Mr. Trump takes well to coercion. And if we do let the EVs in, aside from devastating the auto industry, there's a lot of concern about the fact that they are, you know, they're computers on wheels. They have enormous intelligence gathering potential for both the drivers and where those things go. And if we do allow these, you know, apparently wonderful cars that are very reasonably priced and have very efficient batteries compared to the other countries manufactured, the United States has suggested that they wouldn't allow Canadians to drive them into the U.S. for the security reason. So, you know, we're really in a very challenging situation with China. And it seems to me that our best measure is not to take China on as a strategic partner, but to engage in highly transactional economic relations, not get ourselves into the kind of dependence on the Chinese market that we did with canola, which, you know, is the Chinese tariffs are causing problems for 40,000 farmers and, you know, a larger number of affiliated economic activity that depends on the canola sales, and that we should be looking to diversify our trade to places that we can be more assured will maintain contracts and won't be engaged in state-sponsored espionage to try and undermine our national interests and pursue China's geostrategic aims. And that would be the Trans-Pacific Partnership, increasing our interaction with Europe and seeking markets in places that we haven't sufficiently developed, including Sub-Saharan Africa. So I despair about the kind of rhetoric we're getting out of Mr. Carney that China could be the solution to a lot of Canadian problems. I just don't think that he's well advised on this. And maybe there are some economic interests who have connections with Chinese business networks, who have a lot of political influence in Ottawa, who are giving the government inducement to move into this essentially appeasing mode with China that Carney appears to be pursuing at this time.
Do Canadians just not understand, or have they not been told the story of supply chains, and that if you weaken, if not replace the Canadian auto industry with an auto industry from China, which has overproduced electric vehicles worldwide, what that would do to Canadian cities in Ontario, for instance, and what that would do to mining companies here in British Columbia, which provide material, raw material that ends up in Canadian-made cars. And not only that, the Canadians that work in other parts of the auto sector, whether it's repairs or sales across the country, if the Chinese auto industry was given an open door to come into Canada and set up shop.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you look at places like St. Catharines, Ontario, Oshawa, Oakville. I mean, they're all auto towns. And of course, it would be devastating to those communities. And the other aspect is if we take Chinese EVs, which are dependent on software updates from China, you know, in time of conflict, could they stop the cars? You know, we found out some years ago that some Chicago Chinese manufactured subway trains could have their doors operated from Nanking. So, you know, we'd really have to look into that security aspect of having the Chinese EVs. I think that what most Canadians don't appreciate is that a future global conflict will not be about Canada participating in wars where buildings get blown up in foreign countries, but it'll be about the internet not working, the electricity going off, the water, you know, losing its safety. I mean, it's going to affect ordinary Canadians all around the country when you're looking at cyber espionage and other forms of sabotage that would be used to further China's own geostrategic purposes. And, you know, China's doing that here. We're not able to do that in China. It's not reciprocal. The Chinese are much more aware of these kinds of dangers. You know, they don't allow Teslas to go near any sensitive facilities for the kind of reasons that we don't want Chinese EVs operating in Canada. But I think that the general public awareness of these risks is not well developed. You know, it sounds like crazy conspiracy stuff to, I think, most Canadians. And with the crisis in our relations with the United States, in terms of public opinion polls, you see more and more Canadians who have negative feelings towards the U.S., but more and more Canadians who have more positive feelings towards China. So, you know, the mood seems to be there to support the prime minister, and people seem to believe that what the prime minister is doing with China will help to promote prosperity and preserve employment in our country as the U.S. tariffs and other measures by Donald Trump, you know, maybe even measures that he thinks could turn us into the 51st state so that he could have a continuous landmass more or less from Greenland all the way down to Mar-a-Lago, you know, could be there. I think a lot of this stuff for someone like me is some stuff that we thought was unthinkable is now thinkable. You know, there seems to be nothing that we don't have to prepare for, including a very hostile relationship with the country that we regarded as our best friend and ally, and possible hostile action by China that will transform the nature of the rules-based international order. So, you know, these are challenging times. And I'm disturbed that the Prime Minister is not putting more time into preparing our nation and making us more resilient, and is spending a lot of time traveling. I mean, according to this trip, it'll be Beijing and Davos, and there's some reports that he'll be going to Doha in the middle. I'm just wondering if that's the most productive use of his government's time and energy when we have emerging issues here in Canada that really need much more aggressive and vigorous government action to resolve.
There's been lobbying, active lobbying by some of the West Coast real estate lords, for Carney to relax or even get rid of restrictions on foreign investment and foreign sales in order to bring the Chinese money back into the market, the Chinese money that inflated the market a decade ago. There are forces within the Vancouver real estate industry that want that money back. They think that Mark Carney is their best hope, and they'll be watching closely as Mark Carney visits Beijing. There have been major promises by the Carney government to build more social housing. The housing minister is the former mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson, who during his 10 years at City Hall in Vancouver was perhaps Canada's most China-friendly mayor in Canadian history. Is this a good idea to bring Chinese money back into the real estate industry here in the West Coast especially, or is this just desperate wishful thinking?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people in China who are worried about the future, and you know, the collapse of the housing sector in China itself has led governments to be much more vigorous in pursuing corruption and, you know, trying to get resources from successful business people who, you know, to be successful in business in China, you really have to be involved in bribery and tax evasion. I think I don't think it's possible to, for someone that maintains Canadian standards of following the law to succeed in the Chinese communist state. It just, you know, it's just a reality. So a lot of them do have a lot of money that they would like to get abroad, and they'd like to park it into real estate as they did before. But, you know, from my understanding, from the Ontario perspective, a lot of this real estate seemed to be involving money laundering and benefiting criminal activities by some laundering through casinos and so on. The Cullen Commission brought up quite a bit of that. So I guess it depends on whether the people who, you know, are coming to Vancouver with their money are people that want to live honest lives and contribute productively to Canadian society from their acquired mansions, or whether this is facilitating an element that damages our social fabric. So I don't really have enough expertise in this to assess how you go about it, but I do know that it's very difficult for our government in assessing immigration applications to really tell if the people who are coming are honest people or whether they're implicated in transnational crime. So, you know, the current measures are bad for that. But in general, you know, I believe in free markets and allowing investment to seek its own level. And if there is some degree of unfairness in the British Columbia policies, and I think that should be looked at and the changes should be made, particularly if there are problems with falling real estate prices in that part of the country that are causing difficulties for honest, hardworking Canadians.
Well, thanks again to Charles Burton for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. He's a former diplomat at Canada's embassy in Beijing, author of the new book called The Beaver and the Dragon, How China Outmaneuvered Canada's Diplomacy, Security, and Sovereignty, from Optimum Publishing.
Very good to speak with you.
. 2026 is a municipal election year across British Columbia, and over the next 9-10 months, I'm going to be talking to various politicians and candidates for public office throughout the province, and I thought, what better place to start in Metro Vancouver than the actual geographic center of Metro Vancouver? New Westminster is where Daniel Fontaine joins me. He is the leader of the New West Progressives, and he is a candidate for mayor in the 2026 civic election. Patrick Johnstone is the incumbent, and Daniel has been on city council this term as one of two opposition members in the minority from the New West Progressives, and holding the majority to an account. The majority from Community First New West, an NDP-aligned party. Now, Daniel, you're counting down the months and the weeks and the days until the election, but like people often say about Christmas seems to come earlier every year. It seems that this election cycle is coming faster and sooner than the ones previous. I wonder why this is happening. Why do you think this trend is happening with more candidates announcing, more parties announcing, more politicians who are calling it quits sooner? What is going on?
Well, Bob, first of all, thanks for having me on. I will say your observations are spot on. So what you're seeing is not an illusion. It's actually manifesting itself and has been for the last several months, actually, since basically September of 2025. I mean, if you have been observing municipal politics in the Metro Vancouver region for as long as I have, typically you'll see kind of municipal stuff start in the spring of the election year and then kind of build up over the summer and then culminate in the fall. We have seen an incredible number, like you said, of mayoral candidates, political parties, council candidates either announce they are running or they're not running, as in the case of Richmond Mayor Malcolm Brody, for example, highest profile mayor, indicated he's not running. The mayor of Coquitlam, I believe, is not running as well. So it's to me, I think that it's, you know, there's a number of theories out there as to why this is happening, but I would venture to guess that the most kind of reasonable theory is that it takes a lot longer to get prepared, get organized, in particular if you're not in the governing party and if you're not in the majority on council and you need to kind of raise your profile. It takes a lot longer to raise money, takes a lot longer to kind of get your that brand out there. And I think that's the reason why you're seeing so many people kind of jump out 12 to, you know, 10 months out to get things going. But I also think that the financial part of it too, the way that the NDP government has now set up the system of max donations at the municipal front, you really have to do the fundraising over two calendar years in order to kind of raise the kind of funds you're going to need to take on political opponents.
I guess there are some drawbacks to that because that does distract people that are currently in office from the job they have to do to, you know, for the people. But on the other hand, you can't, as a municipal politician, just call up the richest developer in your municipality and ask to have a big check written anymore, and then you're over and done with. The accountability is there. The small donations, the individual donations instead of the union or corporate donations, that has changed things. Of course, there still are major questions about accountability, and if there are politicians or candidates who are doing the bidding of certain forces in the community, that they can still find ways to pool donations from small groups. And we've seen also the trend towards donations from families. You see common last names of developers who have convinced their wives, children, cousins, parents to also donate. And so they can still find ways to get big donations, but they have to do it in different ways.
There are many loopholes in the way that the current process is put in place. What you've just described isn't a loophole. Actually, it is completely legal for, you know, all members of a family to donate. I'm actually more concerned about the loopholes in the Act, the Elections Act, which allow, for example, kind of in-kind or kind of donations to be provided by way of kind of voluntary labor or kind of phone lists or those types of things. I have some serious concerns with the way, and I've vocalized those over the past 3 years around some, I think, much needed changes to make sure that the playing field is completely level. But yeah, absolutely, the system of financing municipal campaigns is completely different than it was a decade ago, and it's resulting in some changes, and I think we're seeing a little bit of that. And then I didn't mention, but the advent and the kind of proliferation of municipal political parties as well is kind of a new thing that's been happening in the Metro Vancouver region. Typically, over the last 50 years, you know, you've really only seen a city like the size of Vancouver or maybe Surrey that has had kind of organized political parties. And now you're seeing them in pretty much every center within Metro Vancouver. There are very few centers that I'm aware of that don't have political slates. So that's also changed the dynamic of kind of how fundraising is undertaken and the professionalization of municipal campaigns, I think, moving forward.
Now, coming out of 2025 and into 2026, what are some of the major issues that concern you, that concern the newest progressives most, that you'll be taking on the campaign trail over the next 10 months to convince people to vote for you? Well, what are you going to do to change and make life better, more affordable, for the taxpayers, for the voters in New Westminster if you are elected?
Well, first and foremost, we're in listening mode right now. We have been for a number of months and will continue to be in listening mode for at least another few more months until the campaign platform's developed. And I think, Bob, that speaks to one of the big concerns here in New Westminster is that so many people that I talk to and continue to speak with have said that just for far too long, City Hall and the politicians at City Hall have not been listening to the concerns of neighborhoods, not listening to the concerns of taxpayers and small business owners. And they want our elected officials, politician, municipal politicians to listen more. So one of the things we've launched is called NW City Matters. And we're going right into the community. We're hosting about 12 neighborhood forums throughout the community. We just launched an online survey asking the residents and business owners to tell us their perspective, what they'd like to see incorporated into our plan. But what I can say from both my conversations on the doorstep, as well as having listened to many delegations at council and have countless conversations with people, the coffee shop throughout the community, there are a number of issues that are emerging within the city of New Westminster beyond City Hall not listening, which is a critical one. A public safety, the issue of, in particular, our downtown, and we have added a lot of people through densification in our downtown. We have a lot of people that simply do not feel safe, even though there's police statistics that continuously are put out there saying crime is down. People don't feel safe. And so as a result of that, the issue of public disorder, crime, safety, I think is going to be critical, not only through the downtown in New Westminster, but throughout pretty much every neighborhood. So I can't imagine that as we complete our listening tour, that we're not going to hear from the public around that issue. Secondly, affordability and the role that municipal governments are playing in the affordability issue, which is critical. We're seeing that coming up time and time again from all the pollsters who are going out into the field. The issue of affordability comes up. And when you look at New Westminster, in the last 4 years alone, we've increased property taxes by over 30%, 30, which is it's a record amount of property tax increase in one term alone. We have a 3.5% tax levy, whatever you want to call it, a climate action levy. We tax every single resident and business owner in New Westminster 3.5% on their electricity bill. Just for using green energy, we charge them effectively our own mini carbon tax here in New Westminster. And the current council won't get rid of it. They are prepared to keep it going right through to another term if they end up getting reelected. So the issue of affordability is quite critical. And I'd say the third one, which I anticipate we'll hear, and it's triggered a lot of conversations online, and that is the issue of public infrastructure for things like arenas and pools and parks. We are the second most dense city in all of Canada. Well, not all of British Columbia, all of Canada. And yet, all that densification, all that new tax revenue from all those condos and all those new buildings that were constructed, we have a massive infrastructure deficit in the city. Kids trying to get into swim programs is near impossible. They have to almost win a lottery to get into a swim program. We don't have enough libraries. We don't have enough community centers. And so those are, I think, Bob, are going to be likely the top two or three key issues that I think we're going to hear in that listening tour we're undertaking. And our task and our goal at the NWP, and for me as the mayoral candidate and the leader of the NWP, is to make sure we come forward with some clear, simple, and cost-effective solutions to address some of these, not only in the short term in the next, say, 3 or 4 years, but in the mid to long term as well.
The mayor of New Westminster, Patrick Johnstone, who got in a little bit of trouble when he took a big trip to the United Nations climate conference. That was, of course, through charities involving Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire media executive, who's been involved in a number of schemes to encourage municipal governments in various parts of the world to network with lobbyists of major corporations who say that they're environmentally aware and green. And you saw at your council the anti-Israel protests that were going on in 2023 and 2024, especially, that were very disruptive and trying to divert attention from important issues on the ground. Is that something that concerns you as mayor, of trying to make sure that local issues are respected while at the same time dealing with whatever international issues might affect the municipality, as well as trying to protect the municipality and citizens from foreign interference?
Well, Bob, what I can tell you is, and I've been telling this to residents ever since I announced that I was running for mayor and decided to put my kind of hat in the ring, is, as I've said to them, you're going to get a mayor who's going to focus on core issues. You're going to get a mayor who's focused on and excited about fixing potholes and making sure that the cracks in sidewalks are repaired, making sure that kids have access to pools, and making sure that we build, you know, proper community centers in our rapidly growing neighborhoods. Those are the kind of issues that I think people want their mayor to focus on. They want their council to focus on. And these issues that you raise are international issues. They're issues well beyond the scope of the city of New Westminster. Yes, the mayor did have a ruling by the ethics commissioner that said that it was inappropriate for him to have accepted that. And that is now all public. We know that that ruling has been made public. And there's been some changes that have come to city council around the acceptance of international travel and such moving forward. So at least there was some good that came out of that. But my advice and my kind of counsel to our council will be stick to the issues that New Westminster business owners, stick to the issue that the New Westminster residents care about. You know, this whole issue about suing big oil, talking about international political affairs, heading off to international conferences on global climate change, all interesting things, but all should be dealt with at other orders of government who have the mandate and they have the finances to actually take care of this. When you're increasing taxes by 30% over 4 years, I think the public is going to say to the next council, stick to your core issues, make sure you get them done well, and fix the roads, and make sure that we, you know, we have good infrastructure locally before you start delving into turning New Westminster City Hall into a mini United Nations. It's not that's not on my agenda.
Metro Vancouver, regional government, the regional district, which is basically a scandal magnet. Of course, there's the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant, $3 billion over budget. The big question of why it went so far over budget and who is to blame. Was it Acciona, the contractor? Was it Metro Vancouver itself? Was it a bit of both columns? Was it incompetence or was it corruption? We may never get those answered because, of course, there is the litigation between the two parties. It's supposed to go to trial in 2027. If there's an out-of-court settlement on the courthouse steps, that might include a non-disclosure agreement. And, of course, there's been calls by you especially for Premier David Eby to step in, and he has not done so far. So Metro Vancouver reform, will you be also taking that on the campaign trail?
I have been a harsh critic of Metro Vancouver over the past couple of years, and I think it's with good reason. You know, I think, Bob, if I were to make a prediction of one issue that is going to be kind of transcending all the election campaigns coming up, the municipal campaigns coming up in the next several months, I think it's going to be Metro Vancouver. I think this will be the first municipal election, as far as I can go looking back, as many elections as I've tracked and kind of watched, where Metro Vancouver and our regional government, and I put that in air quotes, will actually be something that people are going to be talking to elected officials on the campaign platform. You can rest assured, I've got some ideas, as do a few other municipal politicians in Metro Vancouver. We're going to unveil those in the coming weeks and months, and you're going to hear some, what I think are some pretty innovative recommendations and suggestions around some reforms that are desperately needed at Metro Vancouver. We have an organization that has ballooned out of control in terms of its scope. It's doing literally almost everything but building cars. And if I give them that example, who knows, next week they might start building cars. But they're in the housing business, they're in the parks business, they're in the economic development business, they're in, it just goes on and on. And at the end of the day, they are a utility. And they should be, you know, doing what they do best, which is coordinating the 20 plus, you know, entities that govern this region and make sure that this, you know, when you flush your toilet, it works. When you need your garbage taken out, the garbage is taken out and it's properly disposed of. That's the core business. But you've seen and you've noted the many scandals. I mean, the massive pay that they've given to their CAO. They just recently terminated their CFO. Their CAO is facing a potential vote in a few weeks, potentially even going on suspension. The deputy CAO is on an extended leave. We have, countless examples of politicians flying off to Brisbane, Singapore, the Netherlands. I mean, on and on. This organization is so plagued with scandal. And we haven't even, I haven't even mentioned the Metro Vancouver Wastewater Treatment Plant. I know you did. But I mean, you just layer all of that stuff on and it just really, really begs the question why the premier has been so absolutely silent and unwilling to put an ounce of political energy into making some reforms at this regional government, that I think the voters are going to do it for the premier. And I think the voter is going to look at the politicians who are knocking on their door. And they're going to be asking them whether they're supporting some significant reforms, some of the reforms that I'll be pushing for and others will be pushing for. And I think there's going to be a move to elect politicians who are going to go to Metro Vancouver and actually shake that place up, make some significant reforms, and open it up in a way that it has not been opened in decades. And it's desperately, desperately needed.
And one more question. This will be a question I'll be asking every municipal politician and municipal candidate that I speak to over the next 10 months is about the $10 Freedom of Information application fee. Now, I checked in Westminster's website before we did the interview. Westminster does not charge it yet. Is there any move by the majority on Westminster City Council to change that before the election? Number one. And the other part of that question is, if you are elected as mayor, and especially if the Westminster Progressives get a majority, will you adopt it or will you do the right thing and not charge people a $10 tax to get public records out of Westminster City Hall?
Well, Bob, as someone who has filed multiple FOIs myself over the past number of years, and having run my own blog, civic blog, and used FOIs very carefully and strategically to get to the bottom of issues that were happening. And also, even as an elected official, I've used the FOI system. My expectation is over the last 9 months of this term of office, I don't anticipate there'll be any change to the municipal FOI charges. I anticipate it'll remain at no charge. You have my assurance, and I, of course, we have to talk about it as an entire caucus, as we get ready to put out our platform, but you have my commitment and my assurance that I will not support any increase or any charges to FOI, something that is fundamental to accountability, and in particular in an era where we don't have a newspaper anymore in New Westminster, where the media are struggling to kind of keep the lights on in many outlets throughout Metro Vancouver. The last thing we should be doing is making it more difficult for the media to make sure that people like myself and other politicians are held accountable for the decisions that we're making. It is public information. It is a Freedom of Information Act. I take the word free and freedom of information very seriously, and you won't see that, at least while I'm the mayor. I will not be supporting that.
Well, thank you to Daniel Fontaine for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast, leader of the New West Progressives and candidate for mayor of New Westminster in the 2026 civic election.
For Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Chinese captain convicted of damaging undersea cable deported on January 8th. The man, surnamed Wu, was escorted out of Taiwan at 9:40 a.m. from Fuao Port in Nangan to Huanxi Port in Fuzhou, China, via ferry. He paid almost $8,000 U.S. in compensation to Chunghwa Telecom and $3,000 U.S. to commute his prison sentence after the ruling was finalized. The incident occurred on the night of October 7, 2025, when Wu's vessel was about 4.2 nautical miles north of a cable station in Dongyin. In ABC News Australia, Anti-Semitism Royal Commission welcome, but some say it was called too late. Bondi attack victim Tanya Trechak's grandson has spoken for the first time since Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced a royal commission into anti-Semitism. It comes as Jewish leaders and community groups welcome the move to set up a national inquiry in the wake of the Bondi Beach terror attack. The royal commission, led by Virginia Bell, is due to hand down its report in December. In Kyoto news, China-bound exports of Japanese sake and food items delayed amid row. The slow customs clearance in China is believed to be part of its measures in response to Prime Minister Takeuchi's comments that suggested Japan would act in the event of coercive measures against Taiwan. According to the Japanese Farm Ministry, sake exports to China amounted to some $74 million in 2024, the most among countries and regions. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Oregon Secretary of State asks for $25 million to implement historic campaign finance law, warns final price tag could be higher. As written, the law will limit the amount of money that political candidates, corporations, unions, individuals, and other groups can give to each other starting in 2027, among other provisions. It will also require the state to maintain a comprehensive, modernized system to track political contributions between such groups starting in 2028. With no campaign finance limits, Oregon has seen massive political contributions flow to candidates of both parties. In Cascade PBS, Bellingham staffer asked ChatGPT to exclude vendor from city contract. The five-year, $2.7 million contract was ultimately awarded to Vertex One. Their bid was $1 million more expensive than the proposal from Origin Smart City, which was ranked second best by the city committee tasked with scoring the 13 applicants. An expert in procurement fraud says it's the first time he's seen artificial intelligence used this way. Quote, a classic issue that happens in government procurement, just with a modern veneer, end quote. The information was obtained under a public records request. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind the headlines, such as candidate for Vancouver's mayoralty says he unwittingly dined with Chinese consular official and government supporters. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Crime Stoppers, the charity that takes 10,000 anonymous tips a year and offers rewards to help stop crime. January is Crime Stoppers Month in British Columbia, where the 2026 theme is extortion and sextortion. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 11th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 11th of January in 1815, John A. Macdonald was born in Glasgow, Scotland? The first Prime Minister of Canada in 1867 was also the Member of Parliament for Victoria from 1876 to 1882. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.